You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, my name is David Bryan, and this is Curiosity Invited, a podcast inspired by endless curiosity. Tune in for an open-minded conversation about interesting and important things. Hello, and welcome to Curiosity Invited. My name is David Bryan, and today I have the pleasure of speaking with Roy Whitehurst. Roy has got a great background, an interesting background. He's a former CIA analyst and instructor. He spent 30-plus years evaluating written information, photos, videos, and other media collected by the CIA. And then later on, he taught media literacy skills to new CIA analysts. He's the author of a brand new book, which is the occasion for why we ended up meeting. The book is called Teaching Media Literacy with Social Media News, Practical Techniques for Middle and High School Classrooms, available on Amazon, et cetera, et cetera. The book shows middle and high school educators in civics or English arts classes or social studies, how to teach the skills that students, and in fact, all of us need. In the podcast, Roy and I talk briefly about some of the evaluation techniques he learned at the CIA and show how anyone, not just CIA analysts, can build those skills in evaluating the accuracy, credibility, logic, and argumentation of posts in social media. And Roy, as do I, believes that these skills are critical for us to engage in a civil discourse and build a stronger democracy. You should know that Roy maintains a website called MediaLiteracySleuth.com. I'll put that in the notes, where he periodically posts evaluations of social media news, trending pop culture, et cetera, et cetera. We'll talk about understanding the role of a CIA analyst, disinformation and misinformation in the digital age, applying the CIA skills to social media, teaching media literacy to young people, and cognitive biases and critical thinking, the impact of emotional responses on information processing, and perhaps some insight into navigating conspiracy theories and mistrust, and ultimately the importance of evidence in discourse, crucial to the evaluation process. Very interesting fellow, and with an amazing background, and I hope you enjoy it. That other fellow on the screen is Roy Whitehurst, and Roy Whitehurst is the author of a book that has recently come out, and I want to make sure I got the right exact title, and it is Teaching Media Literacy with Social Media News, Practical Techniques for Middle and High School Classrooms.
That's it.
And yes. So, and how does somebody like Roy Whitehurst come to know something about media literacy? In some ways, I suspect that's the thing that will titillate people. But Roy was an analyst with the CIA, an analyst and an analyst instructor with the CIA. That's the CIA for 35 plus years.
I believe.
And so just so everybody knows, in case they're waiting for the big disclosure, Roy's, you know, there are certain areas that Roy is not going to be speaking about. And I'm not going to try and get him to speak about those. but I would like to ask Roy CIA analyst, you know, we can talk about why or how that that prepares you to write this book. But just for those of us who don't know, CIA analyst does what? I mean, the title suggests you're analyzing something.
Yeah.
And what is it that you're analyzing? And 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 how do you get those things? What does an analyst analyze?
Well, happy to say, in vague terms. Analysts at the CIA are analyzing foreign media as opposed to domestic media. And by media, we mean foreign written reporting that is intercepted or collected somehow by the agency, or photos or audio, all foreign based, right? We don't analyze domestic media, but we do focus around the world on collecting all this media. We vacuum it up, basically, with the help of other intelligence agencies in the U.S. So what we do is most of us aren't born able to do this. So we train, myself included, intensive training, really about, 4 months or so of training to learn how to do this in a as dispassionate way as possible. To make sure that is something that we do without our biases coming into play.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so it's something that I think is something you have to teach. And so we analyze texts, we analyze imagery. In fact, I was an imagery analyst for a number of years where we focused on satellite imagery.
Okay, the distinction between doing it domestically and doing it with foreign sources, is that as a matter of law, or is that that CIA does not bring that intelligence to bear on domestic sources of information, or what? Why was that distinction?
It's by law. We are not without special authorization, we're not allowed to collect domestic, connect domestic, vacuum up information from U.S. citizens, so to speak.
But what about public information? I mean, is that none of that? So, New York Times puts it out there, and everybody gets to see it.
It's something that we incidentally we can use. Certainly we can use if there's media that's published in the United States and it informs our analysis a foreign development, then we can certainly do that.
I get it. Okay.
But that's incidental, and that's not our mission. So our mission is to focus on foreign collection. And we have, help from foreign intelligence partners to help us do that.
I see.
And so we bring it in and we analyze it, and we produce reporting on that.
Is it the goal to discern bias and distortion, or is the goal simply to figure out what the hell's going on?
Well, both. Obviously our foreign adversaries want to obfuscate what they're doing.
Sure.
And so our job is to uncover that, and to do so in a way that is as dispassionate and objective as possible. So we get as many sources as we can to do that. And that includes text, written reporting, imagery. You might think a picture is objective, but it does take analysis, because pictures and photos can be manipulated as well.
Well, right. I mean, so there's the manipulation piece.
Yeah.
And then there's the, anytime you focus... If you point your camera in this direction, you see one thing, and if you point your camera in that direction, it looks like a crowd. But there, it was 14 people,
right?
So there's all sorts of ways of doing that. But I guess I'm hoping I'm not going into a territory. Well, if I am, we'll just edit it out. But I'm hoping I'm not going into a territory that you don't want to go. But in your book, you made reference in passing, really, to, by the way, I should say, I did not read the entire book, but I read a bunch of it, and interested both as a person and as a teacher. but my past life. You made passing reference to disinformation campaigns by, and you specifically named them, which I was surprised, but you know, with Russia, Iran, China. So there's sometimes bias is intended, right? Sometimes information is intended to point you in a direction when really that's not the direction at all, and or not the facts, and other times not. And I guess I would just, if you can answer this, is it, you know, I mean, I suppose this is my bias. I have believed that there are disinformation campaigns being run by various adversaries, I'm assuming. And, and is that the accepted, I mean, is that a commonly accepted understanding amongst your peers in the CIA, et cetera? And you know, I mean, whether you worked on that or not, and I don't want to press in that direction at all.
Well, disinformation is not a new phenomenon, although the term has become more popular because of the advent of social media and the fact that so many of us, or really anyone, can spread whatever information or opinion they want around to anyone, really, right? Around anyone with access to a computer. So the term disinformation, as opposed to misinformation, it's something that is intentionally spread via the internet. Social media, of course, is a big one, to misinform or to somehow
intentionally
do so, as opposed to misinformation, which is something that is done unintentionally. And that happens all the time. You know, the best media outlets, the good media outlets, the ones that are follow journalistic standards will correct anything that's wrong. But so many of us are sharing things on social media and we don't have time to necessarily analyze everything. So we're prone to sort of sharing things that are untrue or partially true, unintentionally misinformation or intentionally disinformation.
Sure, right. I get it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. So, well, that turns the conversation exactly where we want to go, which is, you know, social networks, social media did not exist when you started. Well, it certainly didn't exist in the form it does now when you started being an analyst at the CIA. So, you know, you were obviously working on all sorts of other things and they were fun. But the skills that you learned and that you developed at your work at the CIA, does that prepare one, not just you? I'm assuming you are an expert, but does that prepare a person to, is it the same set of skills that you can apply to social media, whatever social, and is there a reason to define social media as opposed to other sorts of media? You were when it's so rudely interrupted
back
by
then,
modern technology. Social media sources, are the skills, I guess I was asking, are the skills that you applied routinely in your work at the CIA, are they the same skills that you recommend you're wanting to teach young people to bring to bear on social media, or has social media changed the game in significant ways? And like, why does it need? Yeah. Why do you need a book?
The skills are absolutely the same, believe it or not, that I learned at the agency. It's just applying the skills to unclassified information that any of us can, that any of us have access to, and those skills, are accessing media, analyzing it, evaluating it, creating it even. There's a whole part of media literacy that is about creating responsible media. Training young people, or really any of us, when we make media, we want to do it in a way that is fair and just, and we don't try to manipulate or use disinformation to do so. So the skills I learned were the first three. By the way, these skills are defined by the National Association of Media Literacy way back in 1992, but they are very applicable today. And those are access media, analyze it, evaluate it, act on it, or create it and act on it if needed. So civic action, right? So when I created it, I made imagery, or I wrote written reports and gave them to busy policymakers, and they would then act on that. And so I decided, you know what? I taught a lot of these sharp young analysts, sharp CIA analysts that we hired, and they, you know, they come in and they're, I'm ready to learn this. And we found out that they had trouble initially.
Why?
Being able to do this. Well, it's a skill that universities don't teach. Now, by that, I mean, for instance, they learn how to somewhat think critically, but not as much as you would think. And this is really about critical thinking about media. They're all prone to their social media generation. They're all prone to snap judgments, quick judgments. And they weren't as good at it as we wanted. We wanted them to be able to know what their biases were.
Please explain this to me though. So there was a period of time when folks came in differently. Well, this is me, I'm projecting.
Yeah.
Speculating. Analysts, young analysts to be coming in, and they were already familiar with social media, which means they probably were younger. And did they think about media in a completely different way? When you went into the CIA, were you already thinking critically about the stuff that you were reading? And then that stopped? No.
I was no better at it than the folks coming in today. It's just that I like to think that I would be able to analyze text and media, but I didn't have access to a lot of the media that the younger people have today.
Sure.
I did look at imagery, images, photos, and I did, of course, read reporting, and I took time to synthesize it and try to analyze it for a report for school, say, right?
Sure.
Now, we didn't use a lot of imagery in universities, right? This was more of a... that was even a newer thing. I learned the trade of imagery analysis at the CIA, mm-hmm. but I thought I knew pretty well how to analyze a text. Well, a lot of time, and of course we write in a different way in the CIA. We write with the bottom line up front, unlike typically in academic writing, right? We build to the conclusion. And that's a skill that I didn't know.
Yes. Yeah.
Get to the main point. And that is a skill that a lot of social media posts you would think would do well because they only have a few, you know, social media posts are pretty short, relevant, or unless they link you to a longer. Sure. So you have to learn how, or you have to be able to recognize, well, this is the synthesis. This is the key point of this.
This is it.
All this mountain of data coming at us, this avalanche of data coming at us these days. What's the main point that the post is making? And is it a good point that it's making? Is it making an argument? That skill I didn't know. And most students coming in don't know.
Right.
You know, they're savvy at navigating social media, meaning they can find their way around. They can find anything they want. They're pretty good at accessing, but they're not good at analyzing and evaluating and doing it in a way that's to the point. So we taught them that, and I had to get good at that.
Yeah. In some ways, you had to learn from, become familiar with a very different sort of information presentation, right? Media is, maybe there is a reason to distinguish it, right? So social media has come to mean sharing information among networks, and not necessarily I mean, we hear it all the time. Well, you know, somebody's an independent journalist on social media, but journalistic standards, at least as they used to be, there are no, that I know of, right? I mean, there are no such social media standards. And and so it's a whole lot more, a lot of stuff can come over the side of the boat in social media, right? I mean, that.
I think there's a lot more, you know, just a lot more inaccurate information and sloppy reporting. Right. And, you know, and of course a lot, because anyone can do it now, which is great, right? It's social media is democratized information access, so that anyone who has a computer and an internet connection can say what they think or can claim to analyze it.
Here we are right now.
and with a few clicks, it goes out to the world, right?
Right, exactly.
That can be great. I mean, we, you know, I was thinking, what are the positives of this? Well, you can pursue a hobby that you like. Like I love to play guitar, and I can find posts about how to play guitar, lessons on how to, you know, and that's great. And you can learn a lot. I wouldn't have access to these instructors otherwise. It's great, but there's always the flip side, right? And the flip side here is, there's a lot of crap out there that people claim to be experts at, and put it out there. So that's why it's a problem for us.
Indeed. Somebody would write a newspaper article years back, and you know, you'd read it in the daily paper, or you know, the New York Times or Time Magazine or whatever it was, and I don't know that person. There was that sense of, there was a perhaps unfounded sense of trust. Mm-hmm. I trusted that when I read that article about what happened, you know, in New York City, that person who wrote that article knew what they were talking about. Even though, you know, they put it together, chances are they weren't there when whatever event happened.
Yeah.
So they went out and they cobbled together a bunch of different pieces of a story, and it formed a mosaic that they then tried to impart to me, I thought, you know, accurately and fairly and all those things.
Yeah.
So I rested weight on particular sources of information. And now there's a lot of it because everybody can do it. And people are still trying to figure out, you're trying to give people skills so that they can responsibly figure out where to rest weight.
Yeah.
Because nobody is at any of these places, right?
Right.
You know, so that's always been the case.
It always has.
And so now I have to make a decision. Everybody have to make a decision. Who do I believe about? And I don't want to get into the particulars, but
yeah,
do I believe what comes out of Anthony Fauci's mouth, or do I believe what comes out of Robert Kennedy's mouth about those things? And, you know, I try to cobble together my, you know, little remnants, like, well, geez, Fauci seems to have studied, I don't know, I didn't know, it wasn't there, but he seems to have studied at a particular university and is an expert in this particular field, and this guy less so, but
yeah.
So it's a real puzzle, but it seems like it's the same puzzle on steroids.
Yeah, it's the same puzzle on steroids, exactly. I mean, we've always had, you know, since the printing press, even before that, we've had, you know, yellow journalism and rumors and people spreading lies and falsehoods. That's not new.
No.
But the steroids part is that we just got so much more of it now. And the other problem is it's hard to differentiate what is an opinion versus what is a fact, or at least fact-based. Now, nothing wrong with opinions if they're informed opinions, right? But it's so easy now to go on X and, you know, you're charged up, you're emotional about an issue.
Yeah.
You say, I'm gonna tweet about this right now, and I'm going to hit send or share.
Yes.
And then you go later, you go, you know, I really didn't think that through very well. I was charged up, you know, and the fact there's so much of that coming at us that we have a harder time. It's harder for the average person. It's harder for me. It's harder for anyone really to sort of say, well, you know, first of all, I don't have time to analyze everything. So rather than share it, and I'm not sure about it, I'm just not going to share it. And I'm only going to focus on this one over here that I'm going to take a look. I'm going to pause. And then I'm going to decide if this is worth sharing with my network or the world.
Right.
I talk so much in the book because I think this is very important, that the very first step people should take, the very first thing people should take when they read something is, how is this affecting my emotions?
Mm.
Am I charged up about this to the point where I may not be thinking rationally about the topic? You know, there's a lot of examples out there you know, there was one about, you know, Taylor Swift recently. Well, there's been a lot about Taylor Swift.
Almost every day.
I know earlier this year, there was some fake images of well, there's a lot. Yeah. But let's back in early January, there were some fake images of her claiming that she, you know, some sexually explicit images. Yeah. There's more recent ones where she was endorsing one candidate or another, or appeared to be endorsing one candidate and another.
Yes.
And there was some audio that had been manipulated to sound like she was saying it. There was video, this kind of thing. And that's an example of a high profile figure that, you know, how do we know that she did or did not say that? Because a lot of these, manipulations are pretty darn convincing now. You know, your listeners have heard a lot about artificial intelligence.
Sure.
And the concept of deep fakes. Now, this, we didn't have too many of these when I was an analyst at the agency. Now we're grappling with that.
Yeah.
And it's coming from, you know, there's a lot of Taylor Swift fans. Go back to Taylor Swift. Say, I like Taylor Swift, right? I think she's a great musician. She writes a lot of her own songs, most of her own songs. I think she's talented. Others may not think so, but it doesn't really matter. The point is, you usually have an opinion about Taylor Swift. So you're going to approach that media with her, about her, with perhaps a different lens. We might have different lenses or different opinions about her. And that's, so we may or may not believe that image that turned out to be a deep fake, meaning by deep fake, meaning manipulated with a computer algorithm and machine learning, which is a whole nother topic.
Sure.
Versus a crude.
There's so much to talk about there, but yeah.
Yeah. So the point is, it's harder. It's on steroids because there's more of it and it's more convincing than ever if we don't take time to sit back and pause before we do anything else, before we even try to dig into it, before we try to analyze it, just how's it making me feel and what are my biases toward it?
I think that piece that you are focused on here,
yeah,
that by starting with how does it make me feel, if it makes you feel anything, then that's a clue about your bias. Right. Or your mind. Right. Your
mindset. Yeah. Right?
Like, otherwise, it's just information about a singer. Right. But if it makes if you can pause enough, if one could pause enough to sit back and how does that make you feel? If it makes you feel positive or negative, there's information there about how you might approach the rest of whatever it is, this article or meme or whatever it is, because
yeah,
it tells you you're already oriented in a certain way.
Yeah.
And that's, I think that is for my experience with young people, and forget young people, my experience with people is that that is a often ignored aspect of their thinking.
Yeah.
They're not even aware that they have an orientation, right? I'm already.
Yeah, like a cognitive bias. Yeah, we call it a cognitive bias. I talk a lot about these. But mindset's one thing. It's a general outlook. Many of us are look at the world with a more narrow-minded viewpoint, which is not necessarily a negative, depending on, or a more open-minded. But then behind that, that's operating in the background, and then you have biases on top of it. A very common one is confirmation bias.
Yeah.
Confirmation bias. Almost all of us have an opinion about an issue when we encounter it, the latest tweet about it, for instance, or the latest Instagram post.
Yeah.
So we're going to come in, and we're more apt to agree with that post if we already look favorably upon that issue. There's a chart that I have. This, and I dealt with this at the agency back when Iraq when the U.S. invaded Iraq back in the early 2000s. I was involved in trying to figure out if Saddam Hussein had mobile biological weapons facilities.
Mm-hmm.
Well, your listeners will know, and of course, it's very public that we didn't have, there weren't any. But the longstanding analytic line had been that he did have them in the past. And in fact, he did. But you see where that's going. So we had an analytic line, we call it at the time, that said, hey, he had them. He's got to have them now. Why would he give them up? And so
he used to have them, and then he got rid of them.
So we only had one source, pretty much, that fed us information that said, "Yeah, he's got them," and we believed it. Now, there were pockets of the community that didn't, but and I'm making my own. Fallacy here, I guess you'd call it, of generalizing. But the analytic line was that he must still have them because he did. And the report we got from the source fed that because it agreed with what we already thought.
Right.
That was confirmation bias that got us to continue that line and make that assumption. And it turned out that we were wrong. And so you apply that to social media, you know, that happens all the time. We, you know, back to Taylor Swift, whether you like her or not, there are people that don't.
We're probably the only people who are going from biological weapons to Taylor Swift.
Yeah.
No problem.
Yeah. It's a whiplash, right? That shows you the gamut of the issues.
Indeed.
Yeah. It's quite a transition. But the point is, you know, we have confirmation bias about almost anything if we're not careful.
Right.
We have, you know, unless it's a brand new issue, which, I can't think of much that, you know, that is, I guess, but some niche area that emerges. But anyway, we have to be careful about confirmation bias. It's one of the most common biases that your listeners or really any of us are going to face. And I do too. I have to be careful. And that's where you have to pause, right? And say, hey.
Right. What you're saying, I'm pointing this out. Maybe I'm not. I'm about to say what you're saying, but I'm not sure that is. But it's not. You have to pause. But it's not that one should. You know, the opposite of right, knowing that you have a confirmation bias that you have confirmation bias about something. Doesn't mean that ultimately it's a good thing to reject that, right? The fact that you know, you might be right. This information might be right. And that is I think one of the things that is so challenging, and I'm hoping this doesn't get us into one of the areas you don't want to speak about, but it's almost like social media has part of the effects of the steroids, of social media is that it's generated, it's created, you know, maybe it's the opposite of confirmation bias. It's generated a sort of a fascination with conspiracy. This is so implausible that it must be the case. And then, you know, what's developed as a whole, understand the deep state is doing all sorts of things. And it's undermined, at least from where I'm sitting, it seems like it's undermined various communities' ability to even agree on what standard they will use to find truth.
Yeah.
But you know, when you say apply critical thinking, absolutely, mm-hmm. super mm-hmm. important. And they are, and everybody is, but the underlying assumptions, you know, and I don't want to get into that particular, but the underlying assumptions is that, in fact, you know, there really is a deep state cabal that is hiding what was going on in the pizza parlor in New York City all those years ago. And what do you do? What does one do when there isn't agreement about where you know, how do you even reach a conclusion about, okay, that's, you know, it's, I don't want to focus on a particular political issue, but when one can easily say, somebody can easily say, that was all made up.
Yeah.
That wasn't me. Right? This is, now they can even say, that was a deep fake. Like, we know so little and so much about them that, oh, maybe it was a deep fake.
Yeah. Well, yeah, certainly a problem, for widespread problem these days. But I really go back to, where's the evidence? People will say, well, the evidence is hidden. I don't need to produce it because I can't, because it doesn't exist. But that is not satisfactory. It behooves everyone, you still have to go where the evidence goes. Now, yeah, you might not have all the evidence. There might not be any at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't mean that one should go and say that it's all been hidden. You know, you have to have evidence. You have to have evidence. Now, people can disagree on the evidence or on the facts, right? And that's okay. But at least we can have a discussion about, but if there's no evidence that's produced and they're just saying, well, it's, you know, it's a conspiracy. I don't need, you know, or it's the opposite of what the evidence shows just because it can't be true. So it's the opposite. That's a reflex. That's a mindset about the world, because you find that people who have those reactions tend to look at a lot of things that way.
Yes. Oh, yes. And absolutely.
They're not looking at one issue and trying to do the hard work to say, well, you know.
Right.
It's just, oh, well, if it's government produced, it's the opposite of what they're saying.
Absolutely. They're saying this, which means it's not this.
That's not critical thinking. That's not critical thinking at all. You know, you at least have to look for evidence, and one can certainly say, I can't form an opinion, or I can't have an informed opinion because I don't have enough evidence, rather than say it's the opposite of what,
right.
It is the opposite of what the social media post apparently is saying from produced by the U.S. government, and therefore it's the opposite of that. That's not critical thinking.
Right.
And yeah.
I mean, and you, well, you know, if you had written a report based on that, well, you'd be out of a job, right? You know, I mean, you'd lose your job.
Yeah.
That's not true on social media, right? There are no there are no rails to keep you on the road. There are no, one can say anything.
Yeah.
Anything, no matter how implausible, no matter how much lack of evidence. And that's the, it would seem to me that that's the, you know, that somehow needling at, pointing at the evidence is a big clue about how to reach a more responsible, we'll never know. I mean, right? Sure. There's, yeah. I'm sure there's stuff that is true. There's been things that have been true for which, you know, evidence doesn't exist or didn't exist for a long time because who would want to, who would want to provide evidence for that?
Right.
To keep it a secret. So,
I mean, especially in coming from my background, things couldn't be revealed in some cases, you know, because of national security reasons or revealed much later. And, but that's not to say that it, you know, that's not to say that it's the opposite of what, of, or that you make up the story because you don't have the evidence there. It isn't always satisfactory because there's no evidence, but most times there is. Most cases there is evidence out there if people are willing to find it and to set aside their bias rather than just say, oh, it's opposite of what the U.S. If the U.S. government's saying, I'm picking on the U.S. government because it's...
Well, because they're big and you can easily...
And they're big and the government's just a big entity, so it's got to be, you know, we don't need to worry about which department or... No, it's just, it's the opposite of what they're saying. I'm sure you can find cases where that's true.
Sure.
But in the for the most part, I mean, there is evidence out there. There's very few things that are going to be... where it's the opposite of what someone is saying, but you have to do the hard work.
So yeah, that's that right there. It, you know, you wrote a book for prime, I mean, for teachers aimed at middle and high school students. So young people. And so when the teacher runs into this issue with his or her students, of, you know, they come from families, they have, the families have biases that somehow trickle down sometimes. Sometimes they're not trickling, they're, you know, it's specifically inculcated into, into the family ethos.
Yeah.
And so what do you say to those, what do you say, what does the teacher say in the face of that sort of, because that's really, I mean, that's, for me, that's the hope for the future, is that kids, you know, if it would be great if parents put in the work to do this, but the kids put in the work to sort of be able to make some sense, not give up their social media, God knows, right? But to make some sense out of that mess.
And I wrote the book for, I mean, it's geared to teachers in the title, but really these skills I teach, anyone can use them. The reason I focused it on
clear in the book, I think that was really clear. This is for everybody. It says it's for, you know, classrooms, middle and high school, but everybody can learn from this.
Everybody. And apply it to any issue, any social media post that you find, you can apply the skills. Now, the reason, you know, because I focused on younger people because it's easier to catch them early when their minds are like sponges and maybe they don't have as, they're not as hardened and as cynical about the world. You know, there's reporting out there, David, that says that, you know, young people are on social media almost constantly. Almost constantly. There's surveys from Pew and other organizations saying that.
Yeah.
And there's, you know, TikTok. Well, 90% of students are on TikTok or on YouTube, and about 60-something are on TikTok. And then the percentages are still there, but they go lower for other platforms. But the point is, they're on there and they're getting all this information.
Yes.
Let's teach them early on. And that's why I use social media. Let's teach them early on how to look at social media and how to you know, figure out if it's true or authentic, whatever the case may be. But the point is, it can apply to any of your listeners out there who, you know, I'm on social media a lot more just because there's a lot of great information out there.
Yeah.
There, for my hobbies, to keep up with friends. We can all learn the skills.
Well, some of it is just fun. I mean, fun, right? I mean, you can look, everybody watches the talking dog videos, and, and right. We all know this is just funny.
Yeah.
The dog's not talking. This is just funny.
And memes are a lot of fun. But that same reporting about the kids, the younger people, says that a lot of them are cynical.
Yes.
They avoid news. Now, I call it news on social media because for a lot of younger people, I'm talking about teens and even into their 30s, they define news as entertainment, you know, pop culture. It's not just the traditional economic reporting or political reporting. It's what's the influencer saying on YouTube? And so, you know, there's a whole new array of things. But they're becoming cynical about some news because it's depressing. Or they can't, they meaning the younger people. And, I have to say, me too.
I know what you're saying, and all of us, right, yeah.
Look, watching or reading or consuming news, but it's important that we don't give it up. That we don't become cynical where we're paralyzed and we reject it.
Right.
We just have to learn how to engage with it.
Yeah.
Because if we don't, we're not civically engaged, and our democracy is going to suffer if we don't become informed and we don't engage civically, responsibly, civically, and in you know, to help, because and you got to learn how to think. I teach in the book how to think, not what to think. How you should think about information coming at you on social media, not what to think about it. As long as it's informed with reputable evidence, you know, with evidence.
Yeah, so. And I got to say, I think I'm looking at the clock and all, so I know we have time or a time limit. But I think that's the. What I want for your next book,
let me write this down. Okay.
Exactly. Is sort of digging into the question, you know, how do we, what needs to be the standards for truth, for veracity, right? Mm-hmm. Like, where does one look? Because I think a lot of people, and I'm not speaking here just about young people, but a lot of people, I mean, I live in a different part of the world at the moment, different part from what I used to live. So I'm living in Wyoming, and there are a lot of people who are very oriented towards the government in a particular sort of way that I would say mistrust.
Yeah.
But, you know, the Reagan's famous lines about I'm here from the federal government and I'm here to help, or I'm from the federal government, I'm here to help. And that's the scariest line in the world, right? and that's their orientation. And I do think that there's been this sort of generation of a conspiratorial mindset.
Mm-hmm.
Like if somebody responsible, if somebody I'm supposed to take... if somebody I'm supposed to trust tells me something, I'm not going to trust it. And, you know, sometimes for good reason and sometimes for not. And that's the puzzle, though. What happens when we're in a world where we don't have an agreement about how to agree, about what counts as a fact?
Yeah, right.
And we don't even have an agreement about the kinds of things we're going to use to discern facts, and that is the underbelly of all that.
Yeah, that is a big problem. If we have alternative facts, as has been
yeah
term has floated around. on. But you cannot give up what I call the scientific method. You've got to gather evidence. And, the government might come and say they're here to help. And maybe they're not. Maybe they harm rather than help. But that does not mean that you dismiss government in general. For instance, and I'm not trying to convince anyone, but, you know, the government provides services to people who need them. You know, so the point is not to argue that necessarily, but to say that you need to go deeper. You can't just dismiss. It's almost a fallacy, a generalization about a category of things that the world is gray. It's not black and white. That's just the way, you know, that's the way it is. And it doesn't relieve us from the pursuit of facts.
Right.
And to the point where we dismiss, I don't find them, so I dismiss. I dismiss it completely as a conspiracy.
Yeah.
It does make for an easier time to make sense of events that you don't understand. You know, well, you know,
if I could just make something up, I'm good.
You know, for a while, like a big natural disaster that affects everybody. Well, I don't know why it happened. God is punishing us. Maybe that's true. But there's a reason for that natural disaster. Maybe there's beyond that. There's people building too close to the ocean. You could dismiss and say, well, that's due to the government, I don't know, letting them build there, or climate change is causing all of it versus, maybe that's not the direct cause, but it's really the storm. But the point is this, it's easy to dismiss. So yeah, we don't all agree on all the facts, except maybe that the sun is hot. but we need to, it's not an excuse. We need to think critically. And that's why I wrote the book.
Right. And to be clear from my reading, and I read a chunk of it. I mean, I didn't get through all of it, but that's clear. And I think that's, I don't have a critique of your book, but I think underlining that point, maybe that's the point. I had that one question and what I was going to ask at the end, what's that one thing you want people to walk or to take away from the book or this conversation? And for me, it would be thinking critically, working hard at discerning the truth, whatever that means, is really important. And it's actually, it's beyond really important. It's probably the thing that's going to get us out of the, if there is something that will get us out of this crazy polarized world we're in, it is that, is a commitment to that.
Yeah.
It's really important. And that I got from reading your book. Super.
And yes. And I think it's the pursuit of truth. Yeah. Even if you don't feel like you have it.
Right.
It's the pursuit of it that I think we can all agree on that. Well, I would hope so, that we all agree that we want the truth.
Yeah.
And if we're all pursuing it, and I think I give steps in the book about how to do it, at least in the context of social media.
Totally.
If we all agree to pursue it, we can then have a conversation about, well, what are my results? What am I finding when I do pursue it using the tips that I give or at least just curiosity, getting to your podcast name.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let's be curious. Let's not dismiss categorically something. And I think that'll get us a long way.
Totally. I think you're right.
Yeah.
Well, Roy Whitehurst, I really appreciate you. I'm glad, we spoke, as I'm peeling back the layers here, right? We spoke months ago when the book was in embryonic form
Right.
And I thought, well, you wanted to wait until the book got published. And I was like, well, I probably never hear this guy from this guy again. And I'm really pleased that you reached that point and that we got there.
Yeah. Well, I'm passionate about the topic, and I think it's very important that we
totally
think about this. So
I completely agree. Yeah. And I really thank you for your willingness to give up your time.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.